If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Good morning, Steve Dales, Pet World on WGN. And this conversation is going to be a very special one for me for a variety of reasons. First of all, Dr. Debbie Horowitz is an old friend who I haven't talked to in way too long. And the two of us at times would speak together at conferences. And I think it's fair to say Dr. Horowitz has made a difference in the world of veterinary behavior, paving the way for so many others, and also for education, educating veterinarians and setting a standard to do that like few have in the past. And she
You are very kind.
Well, I'm not even done. And she with Dr. Amy Pike have authored, among other books in their history. So Dr. Horowitz, many, many books, many for veterinary professionals, and Dr. Pike, other books as well, including one called Dog Parenting, which is out. But their latest they did together, both veterinary behaviorists, Blackwell's 5-Minute Veterinary Consult, Clinical Companion, Canine and Feline Behavior. Dr. Amy Pike, Dr. Debbie Horowitz, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
All right. So first of all, this is where I start. As you probably both know, the shock collar has come back into use in a way that it hasn't in a very long time. And as you probably both know, I've been very outspoken writing about it and talking about it on radio, doing some TV too, saying, no. You don't need to. You don't want to use a shock collar. You don't want to go to any trainer that uses this sort of aversive training method or this type of equipment. And then people come back to me and say, oh, but wait, when the dog is so aggressive and there's nothing else to do, as a last resort at least, you must admit that this is the answer. And here's what I say, and I want you both to comment on it, maybe Dr. Horowitz first, to comment on this. I say, here, I have the answer. For those dogs, I have the solution for you. The solution, a veterinary behaviorist. Because that veterinary behaviorist has in her or his toolbox all sorts of possibilities that aren't going to harm the dog. And also, being a veterinarian can determine if the cause of whatever issue it is happens to at least in part be medical in the first place. So can you comment on that first, Dr. Horowitz?
The first thing I would like to address is that something aversive tells you what not to do, but it doesn't tell you what to do. So we have to start from the point of the dog picked this behavior because they thought it was the right one. And you aren't telling them the right one to do. You're saying, don't do this. And we all know that there's usually 100 ways to do it wrong and only one way to do it right. And when you do something painful to the dog, you haven't taught them anything. So really, the shock collar doesn't help you change behavior at all. It may inhibit behavior, but what you really want to do is replace the behavior you don't want with the correct behavior, and pain doesn't help you do that.
And Dr. Pike?
Yeah, so true. I mean, and Steve, you hit the nail on the head too. It's like, as veterinarians, first and foremost, many of the cases that we see are actually a result of underlying pain that's being unaddressed. And so no amount of shocking a dog is going to, change that. We actually need to treat the animal medically. And then if, they're so anxious that they're not able to learn in any other way, there's things that we can do, such as, psychotropic medication to really help reduce that anxiety so that they can learn using non-aversive, force-free, positive methods.
You know, we did a book together called Decoding Your Dog, Dr. Horowitz.
Yes,
I don't know.
We how, did.
Yeah, I don't know. It's still selling well.
It was a great book.
Well, you're part of the reason for that. And
thanks.
So much of what the focus on in the book at that time was, anyone can say, I'm a behaviorist. I mean, people were literally, and they still do today even, put a sign, a shingle, you know, is that the right word? A shingle? I don't think so.
Yeah, it's still a word.
Is that the right word?
You have to hang out your shingle.
Okay, I guess so. Okay. Yeah. And say, I'm a behaviorist, when they are really not, and they're using methods that are not appropriate. And again, part of the reason for that book, motivated by many of your colleagues, but one in particular, Dr. R.K. Anderson, who's now passed away, but he was certain that we wanted to say in some way to the general public that veterinary behaviorists are here, they are here to help. At that point in time, Dr. Horowitz, the College of Veterinary Behaviorists had, I don't know, 70 members maybe. And now...
When we did Decoding Your Dog,
yeah,
it was even less than that. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely less than that, because I was number 68, and Decoding Your Dog came out during my residency.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was one of the original first 16.
Wow. Wow. So, but my question goes to this, though. In that book, not only did we write about all sorts of things about specifics regarding dog behavior, but also there was an underlying message that, okay, you need to go to the right professional if there is a behavior issue. Have we gotten better at collaborating with dog trainers, veterinarians collaborating with dog trainers, and also the knowledge that you exist, that veterinary behaviorists exist?
I think there is still... Okay, go for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's definitely evolved since I started in behavior, which, you know, was 14 years ago, I think I started my residency. No, 16 years ago, maybe.
Oh, you're kidding me?
It was. I know. Isn't that crazy? So it definitely was like this new specialty. Nobody knew what we did. Like, oh, you're seeing the psychiatrist with your pet, right? It was kind of, people didn't really know what to do with us. But now it is much more, I would say, ingrained in our society and pet owning population that, yes, there are specialists for a reason, right? If your dog has a heart murmur, you go see a cardiologist. If your dog has had a seizure, you go see a neurologist. If your dog has a behavior issue, you go see a veterinary behaviorist, right? Like just like I wouldn't go see my, cardiologist for a mental health issue, we're going to do the same thing with our pets too. And I think it is definitely becoming more and more mainstream that people seek out care for specialty.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. And I think one of the goals for me in Decoding Your Dog, which I participated in, one of my goals was just at that time to simply rate veterinary behaviorists higher in Google. So if someone typed in my dog or my cat, I suppose, has a behavior issue, and we'll talk about cats, I promise, when we come back. But my pet has a behavior issue, that veterinary behaviorist popped up. And now that does happen, I will say. We are talking to two of the best. Drs. Amy Pike and Debbie Horowitz are here talking about pet behavior, Blackwell's 5-Minute Veterinary Consult, Clinical Companion, Canine and Feline Behavior. And I promise, when we come back, feline behavior at the top of the list on Steve Dale's.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
That world. Oh my goodness, they're here. Veterinary behaviorist Dr. Amy Pike and Dr. Debbie Horowitz. I was so excited. You do a podcast, Dr. Pike, and I was a guest on your podcast.
Yeah, you were. You should come back.
I would. Are you kidding? I'd come back in a heartbeat. I promised we would talk about cats. So let's do that. I'll take one of you at a time. Dr. Pike, what do you see as the most common that you receive behavioral issue with cats?
I'd say it's probably a toss-up between two things. One being litter box concerns, meaning the cat is not using the litter box like the owner would like. And then the other one would be aggression, whether that be aggression to a cat housemate or to their to people.
And, you know, here's what happens. The cat thinks outside the box, or the cat, which was not previously this way, wakes up on a Wednesday. So Tuesday, the cat wasn't like this, but on Wednesday, the cat is aggressing toward you in some way. And Dr. Horowitz, you taught me this, and you've been talking about this for a long time, and I think finally it's catching up as far as people understand that the explanation for what I just described probably statistically may well be medical.
Of course. Of course. I used to know someone who would say, I can't think, I have a headache. And we all know that if we have a bad headache, we're not ourselves. And our animals, when they're not feeling well, their behavior is going to change. So oftentimes, the very first sign of illness in your pet is a change in behavior, whether it's a change in your urinary behavior, using the litter box or urinating or defecating in the house, not eating, eating more, sleeping more, running in circles. A change in behavior is often the initial signalment to some medical issue that's driving that.
You know, with cats, I think even more than dogs, people suggest that the cat is doing whatever, fill in the blank, because the cat is holding a grudge, that the cat is personally thinking something up that's going to get me in some way. Do cats ever think like that, Dr. Pike?
No, I know that look that the cat gives you makes you think that, but it, unfortunately, that's just not what's going through their little brain. They're using behavior as a strategy to control a situation that they find, you know, frustrating or anxiety producing. It is not because, you know, last week you left them for the weekend and now they're upset at you, right? That's not how they work. So they're a little bit more simplistic minded than that.
And they're
I think they use their behavior to advocate for change. What's
true.
Been happening
yeah.
to me isn't working, and they can't talk to you, so they do something different. It's sort of to say, notice me, I'm not right. Something's not right. And it's maybe what the owner is doing. They don't spend enough time, or the litter box is dirty, or they have a health issue. But a change in behavior is not spiteful. It's saying something's wrong. Something's wrong, either it's emotionally or medically.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I remember hearing a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Margie Shirk, speak several years ago about answering a question from a veterinarian in the crowd. She was speaking at a veterinary conference, and the question was, and it's interesting for what both of you do, even veterinarians say, after you talk, you lecture, even veterinary professionals say, well, my cat, my dog. So you get personal questions,
right,
which if you were lecturing on heart disease, you might not get those.
Right.
But you do in behavior. So the question was, my cat is urinating on the counter. And Dr. Shirk said, have you medically checked the cat? And this veterinarian said, yes. And Dr. Shirk said, not good enough, because I believe the cat is trying to tell you something. Do you think that the cat was, and of course, I don't know the specific circumstance, but in theory, do you think it's likely that the cat was actually trying to say, and it's kind of what you just said, is waving a red flag, hey, pay attention, something might be wrong.
It could just be the litter box. I mean, I find it sometimes unfathomable that people, I mean, how many people go into a public restaurant and restroom and they open the stall door and someone doesn't flush the toilet and they walk out and they use another toilet, yet they expect their cat to use a toilet that is overflowing with waste. So people have triggers that make them not want to do certain things. They get a dish of food at a restaurant that's on a filthy plate with food, you know, stuck to it already. They don't want to eat it. And our cats and our dogs are the same way. They're bothered by things that sometimes bother us.
Dr. Pike, you are now in control of the world. Would you, as the person in control of the world, would you mandate that litter boxes for cats be larger?
Oh my gosh, yes. I go into the pet store, you know, to pick up whatever I need, and I look at the litter boxes that are on the shelf, and they're so tiny. Like, you know, especially for let's say, our more large and in charge kitty friends. They definitely need a bigger box. And so I typically recommend to my clients that they use maybe like a big Rubbermaid tote and cut out, you know, an opening for the cat to enter, or like one of those underbed sweater boxes. Those provide a little bit more space than what, unfortunately, our commercial litter boxes, and especially our, those automatic ones, those are way, way, way too tiny for the cats.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Horowitz, now you are in control of the world. So you mentioned paying a couple of times. Do you think we don't pay enough attention with cats to arthritis? Recent studies have been done to demonstrate that arthritis occurs far more often in cats than we ever thought. And then that older cat doesn't use the litter box. The problem may simply be that it hurts to step in it.
It may be that, but when you think, if you go into anybody's house, where is the litter box?
Upstairs, downstairs.
The furthest spot from any human habitation. So that if a cat has to navigate stairs or a lot of different places, and I'm not necessarily advocating that we put cat toilets or litter boxes in our living rooms, but we have to take into consideration the needs of the cat. And people say, well, it smells. A litter box that you keep clean does not smell. Yeah. I scoop my litter boxes sometimes twice a day just because I don't want them to get in there and go, ew, this is disgusting. And I have two cats and I have three litter boxes.
Which brings us to the magic rule, which you can explain about numbers of boxes.
Well, I don't know if it's a magic rule. It's something that we want to at least get people thinking about. Many cats would like to urinate in one and defecate in the other. And if you have a third one, then they're more or less guaranteed they're going to find a clean spot. And like I said before, how many times have you gone into a bathroom and someone didn't flush the toilet and you went out a public bathroom and you went to a different stall? I think what people like about cats is they're very clean. I mean, they smell good, they're tidy, they're clean, and they like their bathroom to be clean as well.
Well, there's no question that my guests smelled very good. Drs. Amy Pike, Dr. Debbie Horowitz, and we'll be right back with those good-smelling guests on WGN. Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN with the great Dr. Amy Pike, the great Dr. Debbie Horowitz, both veterinary behaviorists. And you know what? You guys know this, I think. I revere veterinary behaviorists. Now, veterinary cardiologists, veterinary neurologists, internal medicine specialists, veterinary surgeons, and on, all really important. But the reality is that behavior is responsible for more deaths still than anything else when it comes to our pets. And it's also what we live with every day. It's the human-animal bond. And if that fractures, then it's all over. So you guys, I believe, and I'll stand by this any time, and I know I'm going to get the email now because I began, I will finish. But among the specialties, to me, this is the most important in veterinary medicine. So thank you both for what you do. And Dr. Horowitz, this is the third edition, not the first, second, the third edition of Blackwell's 5-Minute Veterinary Consult, Clinical Companion, Canine and Feline Behavior. How is it different than the first two?
Well, I'm going to answer that, but I'm going to say one thing that I think is attributed to Dr. R.K. Anderson. And he said, people get pets because of their behavior. Mm-hmm. And people give up pets because of their behavior. And that's what makes veterinary behavior so important. What's different in the third edition is that we've updated a lot of the references. We've updated the handouts. And we've broken chapters down into smaller increments so that when you say, I need to know about X, you don't have to read through X, Y, and Z. Wouldn't you say that's pretty much true, Amy?
Yeah. And I think it's, we really kind of broken it down even to the point where we split out the species too. We used to combine Q canine and feline into one and try and talk about both in the same chapter. And we realize, obviously, how important it is to say that a cat is not a small dog, especially when it comes to behavior. And so, you know, we've broken that down. The other thing that I'm really proud of is we have QR codes in this version, and the QR code leads you to a video that actually shows, demonstrates what we are talking about. So if we talk about, you know, we're going to teach the dog to look at that and then redirect for a treat, we actually show you how to do that. And so that is really exciting in this new version.
My God, did it take you 10 years to put this together?
It was a lot of work, Steve. It was a labor of love.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a lot of work. It was a lot of work. My original editor came to me and asked me to do a new edition, and I told her I wouldn't do another one. And I said, but I have somebody for you. And I called Amy, and what did I say to you? I said, Amy, you're really
crazy enough
to do everything.
This?
No, I said, you have everything, but you don't have a book. Would you like a book? And she said yes. And there's, I have to say, not just because I trained her, but there's nobody I trust more to carry on the legacy of this 5-minute clinical companion in behavior than Amy. She's just so knowledgeable, well-read, and has a thriving practice. And she's the legacy for veterinary behavior. We're lucky to have her in our field.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to cry. I'm honored.
It has nothing to do with me.
Well,
and
I trained you.
Well, you trained a lot of people, though. You know, to say that is really nice. And the fact that you have trained...
She was my resident, though.
Yeah. You've had others, though. And, you know, you've...
Yeah.
Which speaks of your contribution to the profession. All right. So let me get back to dogs and cats that people have and common problems that people have. Do these problems sometimes stem from the fact that their dog or cat was not properly socialized, Dr. Horowitz?
Well, it depends what problems you're talking about. I think many of the behaviors we don't like in dogs and cats are normal behaviors but are unwanted. So that cats do cat stuff and dogs do dog stuff, and it's up to us as their humans to shape their behavior so they fit into the human household while still being able to be a dog and cat. So your dog's not going to play the piano, but you can teach your dog not to get on the piano keys. So I think if you have realistic expectations, what dogs and cats can do, and use compassionate, gentle methods to teach them what you want them to do, it's so much easier to show them what you want than to discipline what you don't. And if I can say any one thing that really is the hallmark of veterinary behavior, it's teach what you want. And if you teach what you want, you hardly ever have to do something about what you don't, because you have a behavior that you can redirect the pet to and say, oh, do this instead. And if you start off that way, saying, you live in my house, I know you're a dog, and in my house, these are the things that dogs should do. And if you're reasonable about them, and cats should do, they go, oh, yeah, okay, we can do that.
I'm going to come to you for another question, Dr. Horowitz, because I know you've talked about this before. Do you think that at times, I mean, the human-animal bond is more intense than it's ever been? We call our pets our fur babies. And in fact, there are more, far more, pets than there are children in America. But do you think that sometimes treating pets as if they're little babies is sometimes not fair to the pets?
Here's what I used to tell my clients. The dog and the cat have like a Rolodex in their brain that is labeled with what they can do. And in the dog case, they're all labeled dog. And in the cat case, they're all labeled cat. Dogs only do dog stuff, and cats only do cat stuff. We think of them in a people-oriented way, but at the end of the day, they're dogs and they're cats. And for me, that's what I love best. I want my cat to be a cat, to purr for me, my dog to go, you know, grab and bring back a ball. So I think that we should celebrate
what makes them wonderful companions within their species, and elevate that to family members that know the rules because we've made it clear and we've taught them what we want them to do, and they're so happy to comply.
You know, there was one study, I don't know, Scandinavians, I don't remember the country, they're kind of all the same, I don't know. But this study did say this. The study said the most enriching thing that you can do for your dog, of all the possible things, is take your dog for a walk and let your dog sniff. I want Dr. Pike to comment on that when we come back on WGN. Dr. Amy Pike is here. Dr. Debbie Horwitz is here. Veterinary behaviorists who have co-authored Blackwell's 5-Minute Veterinary Consult, Clinical Companion, Canine and Feline Behavior. All right, when we went to break, I said that according to one study that I really can't exactly cite, but I remember reading this, that the most enriching thing that you can do with your dog is take your dog for a walk and let your dog sniff the world as your dog is walking. Dr. Pike, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Sniffing is what they want to do. I mean, think about how sensitive their noses are. They get all of their information from their world from sniffing for the most part. And so my biggest pet peeve when I see owners out for a walk is they're, you know, the owner typically is trying to get their mileage in, right? Like, we're going to do 2 miles, we're going to do it at this pace, and come on, dog, let's keep going, right? And they're not allowing their dog to stop. And my thing is, if you want your dog to get something out of it, you need to let them stop. I don't care if the entire 20-minute walk is literally spent at one spot, letting your dog sniff what, you know, has been there, check his, as Debbie has coined, check their pee mail, right? So that they can,
yes,
so can see who's been there. It's so enriching. And really, the walk is for them and not for us. And it is not about the mileage. It's about working that brain and getting good things out of it.
Mm-hmm.
They do need to be physical. Depending on their age, they do need some physical activity. But for dogs, sniffing is so enriching. It's just sometimes you have a dog, but we all have had dogs. You ever seen your dog stick their nose in something and just hold it there and their tail is going a million miles an hour? Don't you want to know what that is? Don't you really? I am always was amazed at, like, how can that make you so happy? But it does.
What do you think it is?
I've been out of veterinary school 50 years and I still don't know. It makes them happy, and that's, we want our pets to be happy, and because they make us so happy. And when you find that thing that makes them happy, I have bird feeders out my windows and a bench for them to look at it. And I call it cat TV, and it makes them so happy to watch the cat TV, because at the end of the day, they got to do dog stuff and cat stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dr. Horwitz, if you could advise pet owners, dogs and or cats, separate or together, to do one thing and not to do one thing, and then I'll ask Dr. Pike the same question, what would those things be or not be?
What you need to do is have clear expectations for what the appropriate behavior is for your dog or your cat, and reward that. And the opposite of that is to have clear expectations about what is not acceptable and make sure that you teach the acceptable behavior. So it is much easier to teach what you want than to reprimand what you don't. And animals and humans learn best when you say, do this, instead of don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. There's 100 ways to get it wrong, but only one way to get it right. So spend your time with your dog or your cat, maybe even your husband, and teach them the right way to do what you want them to do. Well, there's a right and a wrong way to do the dishes. We all know that.
I don't agree with that at all. All right, Dr. Pike, I hope you also don't man bash, but how do you answer the same question?
Yeah, I would say my first thing is, anytime an owner sees a change in behavior in their pet, is to head straight to your veterinarian, because most often that is medical, and we need to figure out what's going on. And then thing that I don't want you to do is to not wait until the veterinary behaviorist is the last resort. I hear this every single day from my clients. You're my last resort. And I'm like, man, if you'd have come to me about 7 years ago, we could have made some serious headway with this. So don't ever wait. It's really important that we treat behavior sooner rather than later because they don't grow out of it. I say they grow into their anxiety versus out of it. So yeah, go see your vet behaviorist.
So you can't always prevent a problem in the first place, Dr. Pike, but at times you can, I think. And in fact, that's part of the focus of the book, Blackwell's 5-Minute Veterinary Consult, more than maybe even other editions, is about prevention. So how can you prevent behavior problems?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest thing you can do is socialize your dog or cat appropriately during the appropriate time period. So dog's socialization window ends about 14 to 16 weeks of age, and then cat ends even sooner at 9 weeks of age. So we want to expose them in a very positive, method, so that they're not stressed, to all of the things that they're going to be have to be used to later on in their life. So a broom, a vacuum, fireworks, thunderstorms, all of those types of things that your pet is going to have to be totally okay with. We want to make sure that we expose them in that positive fashion during that key time frame. And that is the best that we can do to potentially prevent behavior problems.
And
later.
Of course, you are scientifically absolutely correct. But at a practical level, we don't want to not adopt a 5-year-old dog or cat, Dr. Horowitz.
Sure.
So at
sure.
that point in time, you've adopted a 5-year-old dog or cat. Are there ways to prevent problems from occurring?
I still say the best way to deal with what might be a problem is to spend most of your time teaching what you want, setting up your environment for success. If you bring home an adult cat and you don't know how they are about using a litter box, then provide them with a safe spot where they're going to live for a set amount of time with a litter box and a bed and a hiding place and their food, and come in and get to know them and learn what they like and what they don't like, what makes them afraid, what makes them happy. The same with a dog. If you have a new dog, keep a leash on the dog that you can get to it right away and you can redirect it. And instead of saying, no, say, come on over here. And it just goes back to, it's so much easier to teach what you want than to stop what you don't. And if you are on top of it, it's like, you wouldn't take a baby and put them at the in an upstairs hall with an open staircase and go, crawl around. If you fall down, you'll learn. You don't do that. you set up an environment so that they learn to crawl and they learn that there are boundaries. And when it's time to learn how to go up and down the stairs, you teach them. And our pets are no different. We need to set them up for success. And even the animals that we adopt as adults, they have learned certain things, and we need to take our time and see what are those and what things can we reward that we want and ignore the things that we don't.
Well, an hour is not enough to talk to the both of you. Blackwell's 5-Minute Veterinary Consult, Clinical Companion, Canine and Feline Behavior, Doctors Amy Pike and Debbie Horowitz. It is always such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
If you ever suspected that your dog is a super spy, you might be right. A new study published in the journal Science found that a rare subset of highly intelligent dogs can learn the names of new objects and understand things simply by overhearing human conversations, a skill previously associated primarily with human toddlers and a handful of language-trained animals, including great apes like chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, and gorillas, but not dogs until now. Researchers say the findings offer new insight into canine cognition and may help scientists better understand how language-related abilities evolved in the first place. The dogs studied belong to a rare group of researchers that they called the gifted word learner dogs. These are animals that are capable of recognizing the names of dozens, sometimes even hundreds, of toys. Many border collies are similarly high-drive working breeds, though researchers stress that this ability is highly unusual and not representative of most dogs. So, to test whether these dogs could learn by eavesdropping, researchers worked with 10 gifted dogs, already known to understand a large language of vocabulary. Instead of teaching the dogs directly, owners spoke to one another. They spoke to each other about new toys that may happen to have appeared, and the dogs observed but were not directly addressed. Later, the dogs were asked to retrieve the newly named toys from among many familiar toys. 7 of the 10 dogs successfully identified the toy, evidence that they learned the name simply by overhearing the interaction. Remarkably, these dogs performed nearly as well as when owners taught them directly. However, experts caution this does not mean that dogs understand language in the same way people do. Rather, the findings suggest that some dogs possess sophisticated social cognitive skills that allow them to interpret human communication in surprising and complex ways. Researchers note that the ability to learn by overhearing speech may rely on broader social understanding rather than language itself, raising the possibility that some of the cognitive foundations for language existed before human language evolved. So, bottom line, be careful of what you're talking about because your dog might be listening. Shepherd Dieter Mickler had no real answers as to why 50 members of his flock from 500 sheep veered off and made their way into a penny supermarket in Germany. The sheep wandered up and down the aisles. Sadly for the store, in their wake, they left dozens of broken bottles. The sheep were not neat, and they left piles of manure. A few individual thieves actually made off with chips. Who knew that sheep even liked chips? It's unclear why the rogue sheep broke off from the herd in the first place or how they entered the store altogether. 50 sheep we're talking about. Customers were pushed out of the way and literally jumped up on the counters to get away from the sheep. All of this certainly a bad day for the store management. True story. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.